Is it a coincidence that Jane and I are both wearing headpieces? I don't know. I think we're. I haven't seen you at the Hatterholics Anonymous meetings. Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you. Or
I'm
good
at the
afternoon.
headband one.
Yeah. Well, I have head coverings of all kinds. Anyway, welcome to day four of the first incarnation of returning to the source. I say first incarnation because day before yesterday, I was talking to a representative of the Russian Guild and who's been on my case to teach again for them. And I was telling her about this workshop. So I'm going to be teaching this in a couple of months in Russia, which means it will take longer with translation, but version 2.0. So it's been fun because I actually found myself thinking about, well, if I have 1.5 times as long and 6 days instead of four, so, the curriculum design part of my brain just started worrying. But before we plan the next family, let's see how you all are doing. So, I don't know. Do you think it's because I assigned homework overnight that some people are too afraid to return to class today? Oh, Mom, I have a stomach ache. I can't go to school today. I'm curious about how you did it. And once again, I would love to hear it from everybody. I don't really know if that's well, I know it's not practical, and I know most people really aren't that interested in it, but let's see how we can proceed. First of all, how many people did the homework? Would you raise your hands? Wow. Well, shiver me timbers. That's almost everyone. That's amazing. Thank you. Well, I mean that. I mean, thank you for, I mean, not just doing the homework, because that just means you're a good student, but thank you for trying something different. I mean, we are in the business of, exploring the new and the unknown. Well, I you know what? I don't care. I want to hear what your experiences were like. And not everyone has to talk. And if somebody says something that relates to your experience, you can just say ditto in the chat or something like that, right? Because we don't have to repeat what people said. I mean, we all have slightly different perspectives, but I'm curious what it was like for you. Let's see if let's take a few more poll questions. How many people found it difficult or frustrating to do? Oh, Myra, don't be shy. Okay, two. Only two people. All right. How many people started to think of how they might incorporate it into something like this into their practice, or think of students you'd like to try it with? All right. Well, that's interesting, Hank. You voted on both that it was frustrating and difficult, and you want to try it. So maybe you don't like your students. Is that just kidding? How many people have I'll say suggestions of how to improve it, what we did, or some ideas? Okay, all right, Rachel. Cool. Well, let's tackle those one at a time. So I would really, I mean, in a way, God, I shouldn't say this in public, but my favorite students are always the people who don't get it or who have problems, right? Because in wanting to reach each of the people in a class, right? Because I don't think you can teach a class. You teach individuals, right? You can address a class, but like in, I think perhaps I always had the tendency to think in an ATM class, how do I teach this so that each person feels like I'm speaking to them? When I started teaching online, which was well before COVID, I got interested in that question more seriously, you know, because of the distance between us. And it's not the physical distance. In part, it's that the ambient environment disappears, right? I don't hear people breathing or rustling. I don't, I you know, all the sound effects that come along with moving, it's harder to sit back and get a global image of the class, because if I do that in a live class, people who are out of sync instantly pop up, right? And I think teaching is kind of like being a shepherd, right? You're leading the flock, but you're always bringing in the lost sheep. Okay, there's a biblical metaphor there too, but you know, the following Christ method is biblical, right? Moshe, Moses, you know, how did we build the pyramids? Big wooden rollers. Anyway, so my question has been for the longest time, right? How do you, in teaching ATM live or online, or well, in person or online, they're both live, right? How do you teach in such a way that each person feels addressed? And I think I said a couple of times, one size doesn't fit all, right? Not everyone needs the same directions. And not, I learned from my students in the last year-long program I taught, the BodyWise course, that you know, that people who are hypermobile, mostly women who have this Donner's, I can't remember the name of it, someone will remember it. It expresses in hypermobility in women. It affects all systems, or can affect all the systems in your body, and it's different in men and women. But people who are hypermobile, when I say notice the space underneath your lower back, they go, well, I don't have a space under there. So, you know, in teaching the class as if everyone was different, anytime somebody who had that experience or for whom that it was like that felt left out. Right? And so if we want to include people, how do we do that? Or you know, so this idea of speaking to individuals and including the class means, you know, when somebody is having a difficulty, then that, I mean, for me, I guess I get excited about that because I can learn, right? In a way, I mean, I don't want to ignore the students who are doing well and who are getting benefit from it, but I feel like me as a teacher and us as a community of learners and teachers, what we the development, part of the development of the method comes from how to address people who aren't reached. And I think that's for everyone's benefit. So, having said that, with the people who said they found this frustrating or difficult, or even if you didn't say that, I'm curious what was difficult. I know who you are. Do you want me to call on you? Okay, Hank, you go first. Well, I know you're not shy about talking in front of people, so that's why I'm picking on you.
You know that's not true.
All right, I know what you do for a living, so come on.
So, a number of layers of difficulty.
Okay.
So just sort of breaking the normal daily routine to say I'm going to do something different for 5 minutes when I've got five other things I want to do. And just the second, it would be just remembering the movements and
So
things.
wait. So just let's do that. Let's can we take them one at a time? You'll remember them, right?
I will.
Okay. So yeah, it's I'm busy. Well, not I'm busy like I just doing busy work, but you have lots of things you want to do. Right? So some of that has to do with motivation. Right. In order to get past that, there has to be something to inspire you to do it. I don't think motivation is enough. There has to be some kind of commitment, right? And what we did yesterday, since I was addressing everyone, I don't think I did such a good job on that in that regard. And I think when you're So I think these are things to keep in mind, right? And it is related to the next thing that you brought up, Hank, which is remembering to do it. I know, like when, I mean, besides my love and Christ interests, there's some other things I need to do every day that are in the domain of physical activities that are good for me, and that really do, I mean, I know they make a difference. And my way of dealing with one of the sets of things I have to do, because it's none of your business, right? is to attach it to an already existing routine. Right. So things like brushing my teeth or just eating a meal, right? So that if you want to add a new behavior to what you're already doing. And that's a step I actually missed yesterday, but I know better, is to actually get people to think of a specific time when they want to do it. And often what happens when they do that is that they'll remember at the end of that time that they didn't do it. That's how awareness seems to work. But if you tell them that's going to happen and they can do better the next time, again, it's not a failure. They'll get better at doing that. Some people are super gung ho, and then there's the rest of us. So I think those are, you're expressing something that almost everyone experiences in one way or another. Okay, that's two, three.
Well, then remembering the movements themselves and putting the pieces back together.
Okay. And how'd you do with that, Hank?
Well, it was surprising. I thought it would be relatively easy just to recreate the movements, but it wasn't. I had to think and I had to explore, experiment a little bit and remembering, what the head was doing or the elbow or breathing.
Okay. Was that it? Or did you have another difficulty?
Changing orientation. So I found lying in bed this morning, I thought it would be pretty relatively easy to do it that way, but I couldn't.
No, you couldn't. Because that particular thing we did is almost, I mean, it doesn't work out of that orientation, right? Because, I mean, this is the teacher's answer, not necessarily what I would say in class. Well, probably this is longer than what I would say in class, but what we are addressing with people, I like I said, we're working in the domain of sensory experience by addressing that through movement. And when we're talking about habits, we're talking about how. So we have, I don't know what's 160, I don't remember the number, I should, 167 bones, is that close, or 87? Does somebody know off the top of their head?
207.
Pardon?
205.
205, Rick says. Okay, good. I mean, we can look it up, but we have a couple hundred bones. We have hundreds of muscles, and muscles are like ropes. If you take a rope apart, you get a string. If you take a string apart, you get threads. I mean, you take a rope apart, you get strings, and then you take a string apart, you get threads, right? There are fibers within fibers within fibers. And there are hundreds of thousands of fibers. And every time you're moving, you're orchestrating the activity of all of those fibers. And one way we deal with the immense complexity of that system is that we organize, those fibers. There's the structural bundles of fibers that we call a muscle. And then there are these muscle groups, we could say, that work together, like flexors and extensors, right? Or more relevant to the lesson that we were doing. Okay, some of you know the answer to this because you heard me ask it before. If the flexors are in front and the extensors are in back, where are the side benders? What muscles are your side benders? I think this is a problem of nomenclature. I mean, Moshe would have loved this question, right? My way of getting you to think about it is I like to say muscles are like moms. They have more than one job, right? And so the problem is if you attach these labels to these muscles, it's as if it were, labels exclusive, like muscles are only flexors. But if you take the flexors on one side of your body, and the extensors on one side of your body, that makes up the side benders. Right? So the flexors and extensors on one side shortening and the other side lengthening, that's side bending. In these, so muscles don't work individually. Muscles don't work as individual fibers. They're kind of like the marching band, right? Each muscle knows which pattern to fall into when. Not because there's somebody shouting orders at them and they have memory, but the way the nervous system organizes them is into groups, like groups of parts of an orchestra, you could say, maybe. And in our work, I mean, when we talk about patterns of muscle contraction, that's really an odd idea, because when you have a pattern of muscle contraction, it's not that the same, if muscles are made up of these components, when you have a pattern of contraction, the sum total of contraction of all of those muscles is kept at a certain level. But the muscles switch off how which ones are working and how much they're working. So it is not a constant, right? The constant is the total work. It's not like every muscle is doing that every second all along. And so we have these, the muscle tonus for a certain group is set at a certain level, right? Doesn't get longer than this. Keep it this short. And that carries on through whatever movements that we're doing. In what we normally think of as a muscle contraction, lifting something up, and here, now don't be scared, it's just huge, my bulging biceps, right? As I pick up, doesn't have to be much weight. As I pick something up, this muscle contracts, that one lets go. If I hold my coffee there, these muscles keep contracting, even though I'm not moving. That's static or isometric contraction. In other words, it's not like I can lock my arm at that angle. So those are two kinds of muscle contraction, right? Concentric towards the center, isometric or static, where the muscle's contracting, but you're not moving. And then the third kind, when I'm lowering, here I can just do this with my arm. If I just drop my arm, this muscle that was working becomes flaccid. Boop, my arm drops. But if I want to lower it, or a cup of coffee, I didn't take my, I let go of my coffee there. But if I lower it, I don't want to spill it. I don't want to go too fast because it'll make a mess. So when I learned anatomy, eccentric contraction was called a lengthening contraction. Now, I don't know about you, but that made my head hurt, right? How can you be a lengthening contraction? That is a contradiction. People argue with me all the time and they say, I don't, that's not it, it's a lengthening, whatever. I like to say it is a controlled decontraction. Right? The muscle has been working and it lengthens, it stops working, it decreases the amount it's working in a way where we're going back to yesterday's conversation, controlling the flow or the speed. It's smooth. And I think that like the jumpiness you see in some movements is that the muscle doesn't know how to decontract smoothly. Right? So flow is directly related. When we see flow, we're seeing the consequence of the contraction of a muscle through time. But flow tells us about what the muscles are doing. I mean, so does effort, but they're different aspects. Okay. Almost everything we do, right? Two-thirds of the type of muscle contractions. I don't know if that's, maybe that's a silly thing to say, but are about contracting. We rarely decontract, and we change the language. Who's we, Melissa?
Those of us who were doing the research at the time.
Okay. So, thank you, Moira. So that was Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which I was talking about. 206 bones, Kira, you win. And so, Melissa, this is from the world of research, movement research.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so the word contraction is definitely confusing when it comes to eccentric, right? So you would say eccentric activation. Is that right, Melissa?
Yeah, sorry, I walked away from the
Yeah,
computer.
no,
Yeah.
I figured you, I
Yeah.
figured that's what happened.
Yeah. So the muscle is exerting force and the ends of the muscle are moving away from each other. So the muscle is lengthening. So, yeah, everybody was confused by lengthening contraction because everybody thinks about contraction as getting smaller, but it's that the muscles are actually exerting force. So they're not decontracting is confusing, I think, but they're actively exerting force when the muscle lengthens. And as you have a good example, when you're lowering your arm and you don't want to just let gravity take over and have no control, or you don't want it to go too fast by having the other muscles shortening that would pull the muscle down too quickly and move the arm down and spill your coffee. You want to have a slow, controlled lowering. So those muscles that are acting against gravity are exerting force while those muscles are lengthening. So if you stick your arm out to the side,
No, I'm look, I'm not
I mean, everybody can feel it. I had
right.
a I went through this with my physics professor, and he just looked at me like I had two heads because he didn't believe this. But we all experience this.
So this idea of when you're lowering, if you don't feel it with nothing in with, without when you're not holding anything, take a book. Like I don't know, something heavy, but not overly heavy, and lift, put your hand on your biceps and lift up the book. Go slowly. You can feel muscles engaging, right? This does not happen on some ethereal, esoteric plane. Muscles are getting shorter. Somehow your intention being turned into action, right? You're lifting it up. Now, when you hold the book lifted up, the muscles don't let go. They're not locking in. They're kind of cycling through which parts of the muscle are working to end up with this consistent shape, right? The book's not moving. When you lower the muscle, you can feel, right? It's getting less thick and short and more long and thin as you lower the book.
And you could feel that it's the muscle is working.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's you can feel the tone in the muscle.
Right. That's how we can sense it. Yeah.
Right, and that's and that I mean I'm grooving with what you said. So I'm just I'm learning, which is the worst thing to do when you're teaching, right? Because it confuses people. So I apologize. But I really like this, Melissa. I'm so glad you told me. All right, so we rarely practice the kind of activation that we call lengthening or lowering, right? But every time you're doing an eccentric movement, you are practicing lengthening. Let me give you an example that you will understand immediately. I mean, you'll know what I mean if you go back and imagine what you felt or get on the floor and do it. In coordinating flexors and extensors, when you have one leg crossed over the other, right? And you're tilting your legs in the direction of the leg that's crossed over, the top leg, the moment you go past the balance point, from then on, you're falling, right? So if you let everything go, boom. I mean, for a lot of people, it wouldn't be pretty because you run it up against your restrictions and you can hurt yourself doing that. But the moment you are past that point, that's all eccentric activation. Ding, ding. Right? So when you change it, I'm back to you, Hank. When you change your orientation in space, when you were sitting up, right, the lowering your pelvis moment is eccentric contraction. If you're taking your head back up to the middle line, well, that's concentric against gravity activation, I should say, concentric activation, moving against gravity. But then when you come back to lowering, at that point, you are actively sensing and practicing lengthening. And so when we have these patterns of muscle contraction, which really don't live, I mean, they are expressed in the muscle, but they are driven by the brain, central nervous system. But when we have that, when we are chronically contracting, regardless of our orientation to gravity, when we're keeping that shape, we lose a sense that we're working, right? I mean, How many times has somebody put their hand on you, or you put your hand on somebody where they're tight and they go, oh my gosh, I didn't even notice that. That's a point where in my head, I go, oh yeah, habituation. Constant stimuli disappear from awareness. If you don't know what you're doing, contracting those muscles chronically, then you can't do what you want. Let them go. So that particular moment in each of those lessons is where you learn to move, to activate the muscle in lengthening and getting longer, in lowering in a gravitational field, not dropping. So, and the moments you stop that in, where you could go further, but you don't even know that for, in the context of the lesson, those are the moments where, I mean, that's where you need to learn, A, that you are activating, and B, that you can lengthen. So that only works, it won't work lying down. Either lowering your head in on the return to the C position, or lowering your pelvis, beginning to leave it. It won't happen because that only works in the gravitational field. Right? You can do the same. So we can do what we call the same movement in different orientations in space. When we say the same movement, we mean that the skeleton is changing its configuration in a parallel way. But if you are, if you're hanging with your chest over the edge of the bed and you lift up your head in that position and you're lying on your belly and you lift up your head in that position and you're lying on your side and you take your head backwards, which would be equivalent to lifting up your head. In each of those positions, the work that muscles are doing is slightly different. Right? It's not the same muscles creating that output. It's different muscles, different patterns of muscle activation creating the same movement. Right? And I think what you demonstrated there is one of the things that makes, we were talking about feeling humbled last night, and that makes me humble because I think Moshe couldn't help but see that, because he couldn't help but see where someone is in gravity, right? That's the judo thing, where's your weight? I mean, that is part of the basis of being a judo master. You have to see that. It has to be present in a way for you without you looking for it. It has to be intuitive. And I think you and I, Hank, are pretty far from that, right? Because in that moment, you saw the shape of the body without seeing the person in the gravitational environment. And well, I just think that means we have to practice, including where somebody is in gravity when we look at the moon, right? Because doing the same change in configuration, if I'm hanging, I don't know, off a fence or something, and I'm upside down, however that is, and I tilt my head to the side, right, and do this movement, it would be the opposite of what I'm doing right now, standing up, which muscles are doing what. Because here I'm lowering my head to take it to the side. If I was hanging upside down, I'd be lifting it. Yeah, so I'm saying that like it's, in the role of the student as opposed to the teacher. I think it's a mistake what I just said, because it assumes that the student should be able to know that. And so I think that was, I have to take that as a limitation on the instructions I gave you. Right? I mean, in retrospect, if I want to prevent that problem for the student, I have to think about how to preempt it. So I have to make sure to say, practice this in this position. Because there are lots of ATM things. The position that it doesn't matter what position you're in. So I'm going to say thank you because I think I learned something there.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Any other things I can learn from? Were that does that those three cover? Making time for it, remembering to do it, and then kind of understanding the necessary conditions. I'm just trying to generalize there. But did you have another difficulty?
I'm a little hesitant if we get another long answer like that,
Okay. I hear you. Go ahead.
so getting distracted, and I would describe it as overdoing. So getting to an ache or a pain.
Oh, well, I'm glad you specified that. Have you all seen there was this is from a long time ago, and not fair to ask people outside the United States probably, but those of you who might have a few decades ago, decade and a half ago, Bob, what was his name? Bob Newhart did this great skit. I think this is like one of the pinnacles of human comedy in the history of humanity. It's called Stop It. I will find it during the break and I'll give you the link. But I want to say to you as a teacher, stop it. Like, I mean, who made that happen? So I think in the context of a class, I think that's a great thing to have happen, right? Because I mean, the only thing that tells you, Hank, is you went too far, right? I mean, and it is distracting because that takes it can take over the conversation. Were you able to kind of rein it in and go back and do less?
Eventually, sure.
Yeah. Okay. So that didn't really stop you, except it reminded you of your tendency. Right? And the reason that's important has nothing to do with morality, right? Like whether you're a good person or not. It just shows the power of that that compulsion, which I think is as much social as it is human. Like, I don't know if, I mean, I don't know outside of our modern world what that would be like. Who knows? But the reason it's important is it takes you out of learning mode, right? It takes you out of the mode where you can. This is just terrible languaging, but whatever. You can change your motor programming. You can change the autopilot. Because once you get into discomfort, you automatically, whether you want to or not, elicit all the subroutines for protecting yourself. Right? And that interfere every time you're in that place where you're vigilant. You're avoiding certain movements where the discomfort is giving you indications of things not to do, is grabbing your attention and drawing it all to one place and robbing you of the spreading of attention and the noticing your whole self. I don't want to be poetic there, but the reason all of those things are important is that they are the hallmarks of where you can change things. And I'm making an explicit effort to talk about it in a way where it's like, in a way, I don't know, it's like carrying water in a pail with holes in it, right? In terms of doing the lesson, you're doing a lesson in which part of what you're trying to get from the lesson is disappearing as you're trying to get it, right? You're trying to capture something, you're trying to change something at the same time that the way you're doing it is interfering with changing it. And that is in your control. And I think that that speaks to something which is related. Whoops, I don't know who that is. Could yeah, Sherry or somebody, or Jane, could you find out who's not muted and mute them? Thank you. But I also think that's part of our job, right? Part of our job as teachers is to, it's not just help the students learn from a particular lesson, but help them understand why being in learning mode is important and holding them accountable to it, right? So that when somebody drifts away or does something that makes it more difficult for them to learn, goes to the end of the movement, or goes as far as they can, or over efforts, or goes so fast, right? I mean, going slow is important because there's lag in all biological systems. So it takes a while to notice and to notice what's happening. By the time you notice it, it's over. These things are necessary. And so if we think of part of our job, not just as instructing students to do a lesson, but let's say coaching them in being better students, right? Being able to get more from the lessons. And really, it has to be more like being a coach than like being a parent of a teenage child. Right? I do not want to be in a situation where I'm talking to Hank, to you, as if like you should know better. Right? Because that's just going to elicit that. I mean, we can keep getting better at being better students. And I think we, you know, if somebody isn't doing that, then I would even directly ask them. I said, well, look, if you're spending time coming to class and you have these things you say you want to learn, are you willing to make the changes, even though they might even feel uncomfortable at first to change how fast you go or your tendency to work really hard? But are you willing to look at that? Because I don't think you're going to benefit from the lessons unless you're willing to change that. You know, and I at some point, if someone is doing lessons in such a way that they can't benefit from them, should they really be in my class? Right? I mean, that's we could talk about that at a different time, but it's like, why wouldn't I encourage them? Why wouldn't I challenge them about those things? Right? In terms of how they're doing the lesson. I don't mean necessarily in front of the class, and I do mean using every one of our teaching tactics, which means overall in the class, starting from the most indirect indications, right, to the most direct. I mean, there, I hope, in your whatever bag of tricks, toolkit, you have lots of ways to think about that. But I think that If you say that to me in a class, like say in an ongoing class, Hank, that I will think about you as a student, and I'll also think about if it's not the first few classes, how did we get this far along in a class with you not having an active way of saying, oh yeah, I did it again. Right. And this is some, I'm, it's not like I'm just working on this homework assignment, but I'm also, I don't know, what's the equivalent? Developing better study habits? I don't know. If Feldenkrais was a sport, it isn't, but if it was, I wouldn't just be coaching you in the whatever we're doing. I mean, throwing a javelin, but in sensing where your weight is and how you shift it in all sorts of situations, so you could apply it in that, right? As a Feldenkrais teacher, like finding the movement of your center and connecting it to your arm and connecting it to your base of support. Those are the underlying skills. So I wouldn't be just teaching you the activity. And I think, doing less and slowing down, I think we could take that way more seriously. Right? Of course, I mean, if I don't know if there's one extreme, right? This is closer to how Moshe taught classes. People came in, they lay down, they shut up, they do what he tells them to do, they learn something, and they go home. Well, I mean, that's a really easy job as a teacher. Right? Because there, I'm just teaching a class, and Moshe does interact with people, but in ways where it's as much as an example for the class as it is for the person. Maybe it's always that, but I don't. I guess, I'm not satisfied as a teacher in that situation because I don't know my students. So I guess that's more teaching a group. And I think, it's not like but look, even I don't know, this is turning into a confessional moment, but when I was teaching at the university the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, in the kinesiology department, one of the first assignments was to teach the introductory kinesiology course, the 101 class. And I had 29 to 32 students in those classes. One semester, I had three sections. And I was at a faculty meeting, and one of the, I was a lecturer, and one of the professors had been there for a while and was tenured. He leaned over and he said, "Are you trying to make us look bad?" I was like, "No." I said, "Why do you say that?" And he goes, "Well, I hear that you're having every undergraduate in your introductory seminar write a paper every week. That's crazy." And I looked at him and I said, "Well, I think walking into a classroom of 29 undergraduates and not knowing what they're thinking, that's crazy." Right? I mean, there were one-page papers. It took me a lot of time, but I wasn't performing for an auditorium or for an audience. I was teaching the individual students in the group. And I thank you, Ernie. So maybe that has to do, I'm taking responsibility for my perspective. It doesn't fit the model that Moshe laid down. So Am I saying he's wrong? No, because I can't, because he invented the method. And but I'm saying, I guess for me, I am not satisfied with the benefit I can provide people when I teach, when I treat them all as one lump. And I think, like I said at the beginning, groups don't learn, individuals do. So I think it's a mistake. For me, it is unsatisfactory. Now, of course, I could follow the shepherd strategy and just deal with the people who are having a problem, but I'm not satisfied with that either, right? Because I think everybody deserves to be recognized. All right. Sorry, I went off on a tangent there because I guess that tells you something about my perspective. But so, Richard, we're done with you. Be gone. No, it wasn't Richard. It was Hank. Sorry. Looking at the wrong person. Hank. Who is the other person who had difficulties? I don't remember. Did you leave?
Myra.
Oh, Myra, thank you.
I think you've talked about it though, especially just recently, because my difficulty was making it slower and smaller. And I know that's not new for me. And I did this very late at night. I didn't do it against the roller. I was sitting on the edge of the bed, so I wasn't exactly the situation. But I also, the second thing is that I couldn't let it go, and I was perseverating, so I was doing it in bed on my side, not intentionally. It was like falling asleep to this movement, and then realizing that it was not the same movement, but it was the same shape. So I just found that not surprising, and interesting. And I did do it this morning, and this morning it was a lot easier back into the position that I used during class.
Yeah, okay, cool. Right, so and then for those of you for whom it worked, right? What was that like? What was, so I mean, you remembered to do it, you did it, and you got something out of it. So what was that? How, was it anything different from the usual? Did you manage or somehow did this, did reminding yourself of that section serve to bring back some of the feeling of the whole lesson or the lesson fragment? Hi, Kira.
So I found that I really had to decrease the movement as I was doing it, and I had to make it so much smaller than I expected that I needed to make it. But what I also discovered was that there were some when I did start to do the letting it go slowly, I really started to find places of movement that were totally new and unexpected for me.
Okay. So, and what was your feeling? What was your evaluation of doing it? I mean, afterwards or now?
Well, I found it very helpful. I found myself able to move in a way that I had not been able to move, and much more freely in the new side that I was moving to.
Okay. Thanks. Someone else? Yeah, Nancy. You had your hand up before.
What when I reviewed over it last night, I did on the other side, and it felt good movement in both. I was thought it was a good check-in after the lesson, and I can see the benefit of suggesting that to my clients. This morning when I sat down, I sat there and my pelvis was hyperextended. When I first sat down, I couldn't come to get into that comfortable place. I had a hard time lifting the right side. So I'm guessing that I was going back to my old pattern or the old way, or so I could see. And so I spent a little time with it. I didn't spend a lot. But I also went for a walk afterwards. And one thing I noted from doing the lesson yesterday was my pelvis was a lot freer. And so going for a walk really kind of balanced that out. But I certainly can see the benefit of suggesting this to client, and even just the one little piece and not spending a long time, to me had a big benefit. It kept it into my awareness, and it helped carry it forward.
Yeah, because if we don't do that, that doesn't happen for most, for most of us, right? I mean, look, we're all like ATM geeks or nerds or whatever, right? I mean, compared to the general population, and even compared to the group of people who come to our classes, right? And if we don't think about it in between, and we don't think about it in a way, if we don't return to that way of noticing and that those activities, it's like we're believing something's going to change without us paying any attention to it, without us doing anything. And I mean, yes, some things happen that way, but it's not like we're battling the habit. It's like we have to practice doing something different in that moment, right? And what's the only thing that we can do different is change what we're doing. And if we're not, I mean, I'm just saying what Moshe said, but I am taking really seriously, right? The first step, if that dictum is true, is to notice what you're doing. And the sad thing is, as you a couple of you have said, is you're doing it again. There you go again, right? And between giving up and thinking that it somehow will magically change, somewhere in the middle, there is a process that we can engage in with ourselves that will help us change it. Because come on, how many of you, I mean, we've all had students say this, but how many of you have gone back and done a lesson and just thought, well, I lost it all. Where did it go? How come I can't keep any of it? But we kind of like ignored that question and kept going. Uri.
I enjoyed actually, I said yesterday, I felt like a pancake after the lesson, and it was a very pleasant feeling. And I took last night was less effective, but this morning again, this exercise, as I wanted to meet that one nice, pleasant friend that I met yesterday. And with that intention, it was the, he was there, she was there, and it felt great. And I'm saying it because I'm in Feldenkrais because of my music mostly. I want to make better music and teach my students to make better music by becoming aware of what really makes that music, who makes that music, and who is the person. And for me, every time I discover something that captivates my heart, my attention, I want to keep looking for more and more of that. So maybe that's how I approached this exercise this morning.
Sounds like a reasonable motivation, huh?
It was definitely good for me.
This is to serve a symbolic gesture. I'm changing hats because I want to change perspectives for a moment. Because I could talk to you, let's say, as a student, and I'm in the teacher role, but I could talk to you as a teacher role, as a teacher, and then I'm in the trainer role. I want to talk about what you said, just so we keep these distinct for a moment, from the teacher's perspective, right? So what I heard you say yesterday when you said this about the ATM is that the lesson, I think of it as it interrupted your pattern. So the thing that you do compulsively, which is your habitual body print is a result of your habitual tonus, right? The way you hold yourself. That lesson broke. For a moment, it interrupted the pattern. So, it's like when it comes to habits, you don't get out of jail. You might get a temporary day pass, right? But that reminds you what it's like to not be there. And it also gives you the experience that you're not condemned to this forever, which means that working on changing isn't based on hope. It's based on experience. You know, what we, as teachers, I think what we have to say to our students is, I can help you get there, right? I can get you there. I can lead you there with my hands or with my words. And I think we have to be able to say to them, I can get you there with my help. And I'm just as good at teaching you how to get there on your own. Right? And what you just demonstrated or you illustrated in your story this morning, you were able to get that effect of interrupting your pattern. So the answer to my question earlier would be, can you use this brief moment to get the benefit of the entire lesson? And so I think your answer to that question would be yes. Does it last forever? No, but it does show you that it is within your power to do something about it. And I think each of these smaller successes is part of what builds up the ability to actually have a choice. We're never going to get rid of the patterns that we learned. You cannot unlearn something. Just not the way the nervous system works. You can undo it, right? So if you have a severe injury and you are limping for a long time and you are in pain, the longer that goes on, the more you undo what you've learned. You didn't unlearn it. It just became chaotic and something else, something more constricted, replaced it. But here we're talking about developing another choice, another path compared to one that's well-worn, right? So I think, again, if you think about this over time, that someone's not going to change their habit in one lesson. And changing the habit at some point means that you can consciously do something different from what you are unconsciously doing, right? So how do you stop doing something that's happening unconsciously? Well, the answer I don't know if it's the only answer, but one answer, the answer that I think our work is based on is you can only stop doing it unconsciously if you can do it consciously. And if you don't know that you're doing it, you'll never be able to do it consciously, right? And in your example, Yuri, about working with musicians, it is not enough to know how to play better. Because the thing that stops, from my understanding as a Feldenkrais teacher, the thing that stops you from playing better is not what you can't do, it's what you can't stop doing. Right? I mean, I think that's the basis of our work. As Feldenkrais teachers, we are interacting with and speaking to the physical manifestations of the unconscious. I don't need to be a Freudian to talk about the unconscious. A limp is the unconscious. Everyone can see it, except for the person who has it. Right? I think that's the domain of our practice. So making things conscious, I think it's a part of it, because if it isn't, then our work is, if we just improve how someone's moving, and it's not a matter of choice and it's not a matter of awareness, we're just making them unconscious in a better way, mechanically better way. But that doesn't seem to be what our work is about, right? Yuri.
Yeah, just to clarify something. It's not I don't mean usually making them play better, my students. I mean communicate more effectively or more what it is that they burns in them to and wants to communicate with others. And then you find the ways to do it and realize what your patterns are. So for me, meeting a good friend is they're not there around me all the time, but and they will disappear. And but meeting them just reminds me the good feeling, and I want to do it. That's the analogy for me was.
I am. Yeah, I think I know what you mean. I mean that, and I have that same experience. But it's also like meeting a good friend. It feels like no time elapsed since the last time you saw them, right? I mean, it's a feeling we all have. I like that. All
Okay.
right. I'm being quite philosophical about this. I mean, I want the philosophy of our, Moshe's methodology, of the tradition that we are a part of. I want to lay bare, I want to make evident the thinking behind what we're doing. I want to, in a way, think about it and practice it at the same time here in this particular situation, because I think that's where developing the method comes from. And I hope that these things that I am proposing and the way that I am talking about it gives you a sense of this thought experiment, right, that I asked you to participate in 2 weeks ago yesterday, which is what if we took seriously this idea that the pattern is going to return, that it's not a surprise, it's not like a one-off, it's like more than likely, eventually, usually sooner rather than later. And what if we took it to think that this is something that we need to address if we want to help people learn to move differently? Or in terms of what Yuri said, it's to turn their intention into action. Right? And what interferes with that? Well, it's the things you already learned. And not in some abstract conceptual way, but in the fiber of our being, how and what we notice and how we move, how we respond. And if we're in the field of changing those things, then it can't be changing something in the moment or in the time of a lesson. And our job, I think what I'm proposing is to think about, and I hope what I'm demonstrating is how we might engage with this process of learning in terms of what happens outside of the confines of the time we spend with our students. Right? Which is what they do on their own. And how important that can be. And you know, I chose this theme about that, you know, I'm challenging an idea that I think many people have as students and as teachers too, that you have to redo the whole lesson in order to get the benefit from it. And, you know, like Hank was having a hard time thinking about how to fit 2 5-minute interludes into a 24-hour day. And what if we ask them to do an hour every day? Right? I mean, there's certain people who do a lesson every day. And I think Mark Reese, or he said, did 2 lessons every day, most days. Right? And I think he did that in part, just that was his way of taking care of himself physically. But, you know, if you don't have that inspiration, it feels like a lot to ask people to take an hour out of their day. I mean, except for the people who do it every day, and they can't understand why the rest of us don't. But I don't think that there's the practical side of it, but there's also like, oh, that's a huge burden to put on our students. And, you know, I don't think we want to ask that of most people, or we might mention it. But if we say that we are practicing the method, what does that mean besides going to class? I mean, like, is there anything in the world you can learn just by going to class? Let's take a break. I'll see you at the bottom of the hour.
Is the bottom of the
start the recording. Hi, welcome back. I promised myself a long time ago that I would do this hard work as long as I found it interesting, as long as I was learning. I mean, the thing I loved about Moshe when I met him was he was younger than I am now, I think. No, probably not. He was older than I am now. But he was still learning. Like, how many people do you know in their 70s that are still learning? Right? And I thought, I want that. And, you know, I said, if I get tired of it or, you know, I stop enjoying it, if I stop learning, I'm going to stop.
Yes.
But like today, I learned so much, you know, from our discussion here, in part about what I'm trying to get at. And one thing I learned, which is kind of maybe, you know, at home we call it stupid smart. I mean, it sounds really smart, but it's kind of stupid. but one thing I learned is it's not just about the homework. Right? It's about the attitude you have toward what it's going to take to make something change, right? The engagement. And so, I mean, I kind of handed off something to you in a cavalier and offhanded fashion, and I realized that it does require, like changing your hat, changing an attitude toward what we're doing. And that can't be something that you just give to someone. It has to be woven into how the class is conducted or how you work with your students. Like if you give homework, you must follow up on it. Well, unless the student's a self-starter and that would annoy them or interrupt. I don't know, but I think with most people, because you don't know what someone learned until they come back. Right? If somebody says to me, "Can you fix that?" And I say, "Well, I don't fix things. I look at how you move. I figure out how the difficulty you're having is a result of how you're moving." And then I help you learn how to move differently. Well, how long will it take me to learn to move differently? And if it's the first lesson, I have to say to someone, I have no idea. Right? Because we haven't even had one step where we did a lesson together. You went home, did whatever you do with it, and you brought back whatever you still had. And I would know what to do next. And after we've done that a few times, I probably have a better idea of what you need in order to make these changes. But that whole thing is, that's me being a teacher and me taking seriously that one size doesn't fit all and that I have to figure out how to help you. Kind of learner you are with the history you have and with your motivations, what do you need in order to be able to do this? So anyway, I think like I think I build that in from the beginning, right, of working with people. And I guess I'm realizing how necessary that is. It can't be like a groovy new trick to remember a lesson, right? Or to make the lesson stickier. It requires my part as a teacher to have a different attitude and set of expectations for the student from the get-go. Like, the question, how many sessions will this take, is based on the assumption that there is, one sequence of mechanical adjustments or even one sequence of lessons or content, but it doesn't take into account how what challenges you might have in learning that or how stubborn some aspect of the habit is because of whatever. And so I don't think what we're doing is that kind of thing, right? Where there's a standard curriculum that you can follow, and it's the same for every human being. And in fact, what makes this interesting for me is not the orchestration of the movements, like, I don't know, conducting a ballet or something, but it's helping each person use the lesson to be better able to do what they want to do. Right? But that means I need to know the person and what they want to do and something about how they learn, which is not like they're hiding it because they're doing that all the time. Anyway. So I guess I'm saying maybe it's not a surprise that this is really is a shift in where you're coming from and how you're responding to students. It's not something abstract. It has to show up in the way that we behave, because right now we behave as if that's like it has nothing to do with us, right? Right? That's the way you learn. Maybe it's a given, but I thought we were teaching something about learning to learn, right? So it can't be a given. It can't be something that happens automatically. And I don't think learning can happen just in the classroom, right? So I just realized I'm asking way more of you than I thought I was. I'm not going to apologize for that. I mean, I don't think it's wrong to ask. You don't have to do it. But I'm realizing that this is not a trivial change. I mean, I would argue it's a really worthwhile one. But I thinking that made me, yeah. So I mean, I just spent the entire break having a conversation with myself about what we're doing here. and not an academic one, or yeah, one about curriculum. What can I do to help? You know, as pretending, imagining that you wanted to get a better sense of what it would be like to do this, because I think the ideas we've delved into, I think I know the answer to that. But before we do that, I think I should give you a chance to say whatever you might have thought of during the break, or right now. Yeah, Betty.
Relative to what you just said, I thought maybe what we're talking about is being able to be our own classroom as students. That when we, as teachers, when we propose to teach and mentor students, that, as you said, when the student knows more, can do it better than the teacher, you've probably been a good teacher. But the image I had was that modeling and mentoring in class, the tone of voice, the interactions with each student and the students with each other, whether that's on Zoom or in person. Most of my classes have been on Zoom, and the class I take is on Zoom. So all those clues of how I show up as a person in class, as teacher or a student, is part of the learning for other people, as well as the history and tradition of ATM and the lessons that we put together and teach and rely on that initial structure. So that a student carries the classroom within themselves wherever they go. I think that's.
I think you said more than that, right? Than your last sentence. Mm. And for me, there are a couple things about that. One is that we make the class about what happens in the classroom. You know, the students' questions, their responses, our experience and reflections. I think a rubric would be something like that we want to demonstrate learning and not teaching. So, you know, that includes like the conversation I just had, which was about me learning. Right. So if I want to set a good example, I shouldn't be acting like a know-it-all. I should be acting like someone who's capable of learning from their experience.
Well, isn't that a both and? I mean, to me, that's a both and. That's sort of a both and
Absolutely.
identity. And another thing I've been mulling over, but it's sort of a philosophical sort of conversation. So I don't feel like we can, I don't know if I want to bring it up right now or not. So I
Okay.
can
No,
save it
that's
for
fine.
later. So the language of the tacit dimension is something that I'm familiar with from a long time ago, reading and studying an author named Michael Polanyi, who was talking about the way we know things and how we know things. And it's to me, when we talk about what we do automatically in habit. And habit and unconsciously, I think Polanyi might say that, in our embodied existence, we begin to create a background of embodied living that we rely on uncritically in our actions. So, as we learn to ride a bicycle, we fall and we break it down into these little pieces. But once we learn to ride a bicycle, we rely on all those skills that went into the background, compared to our focal attention, which is connected, but it points us away from everything that we've learned that we rely on to act, to enact, and whether that's speaking or moving or related to a particular function. So I'm just wondering if, and that's when we talked about doing and learning, or noticing and learn, or noticing and doing. To me, those are again linked. It's just that our attention, when we focus our attention in one place, other things go into the background. And my experience as a student, is that ATM lessons and functional integration lessons enrich our tacit knowledge. And we, whether we know it, whether we bring it into our attention to understand all of that is part of the choice making of maybe recognizing there's a habit that we've relied on a long time that is no longer serving us. We have to become
So,
conscious of it.
wait. I think I'm going to pull you back from the brink there,
Okay, very good. And
because I think what the way what you're saying is fitting with what I'm talking about is I was just thinking you used the word tacit a few times. I understand where it's part of is it Polanyi? I've never heard the name spoken, but I've read him and I know who you're talking about. It has something to do, the habitual is unspoken, right? And it's unnoticed. And part of what we're doing in our practice, which is about awareness, I'm going to set that word aside because it's not a thing, but it's about noticing. And you talked about this as noticing, right? The activity of noticing. But we're noticing what is usually unnoticed, right? That's part of it. And we're making the, it's kind of one way you could say that Moshe's project, our method, is related to, psychoanalysis and Freud is making the unconscious conscious, right? And here, the unconscious that we're talking about is what we're physically doing at the moment, right? In other words, we're saying that we don't know what we're doing. And what you're saying, what you added to that, Betty, is like, And that we count on that all the time.
Yeah, we do.
Right? Yeah, which I think that's, it's like habit isn't a bad thing. And there isn't, I mean, good and bad habits, those are labels we put on them. They have to do with the consequence, but the habit itself has no value. It's just a habit. It doesn't even have an opinion. So the question is, I mean, in a different way of talking about it is, how do we update the autopilot? And we're saying that this requires a kind of engagement that we don't normally think about. And I think where that philosophy, which is really, I mean, I love what you said. And Betty, we can have a cup of coffee any day,
Okay, good.
virtually or online, because you're talking about the branch of
Phenomenologies.
philosophy that I enjoy the most, which is epistemology. How do we know what we know? And I think what we're doing as a methodology is the embodiment part of how we know what we know. Like it's not an abstract. So I'm glad to talk to you about it. But getting back to the practice part, because what Moshe did in his developing the method is what we often don't do in talking to other people about it, which is he started with, so what? Nice idea, but so what? What can I do with this? Like he was in some ways such a practical person, and I think sometimes when we're teaching, we assume that people know that, but often people are left asking, well, so what? And the so what is like how you can use this. How can you use this to improve yourself and develop choices, not be going through the motions of life, right? Like automatically, not having a choice. I think that's the domain in which we're acting. So thank you. Anybody else about reflections about this, your practice, your experience? I know I'm putting you on the spot, but like I think I know personally, have been in the room for more than a few minutes and often for some really poignant moments. I mean, half of you in this room, right? So I don't think about this as a dog and pony show for a bunch of strangers, and I'm relating to this not just as your colleague, but personally, because it has to do with my experience of being a Feldenkrais teacher and wanting to be a better one and whatever. So I will stop, but I'm really really curious about how this hits you and how you feel about it. And we don't have to discuss it publicly, but I'm open to talking about it or reading about it later. So here's what I'd like to propose. I don't think anyone will object to this, right? Because I think it's probably the least objectionable thing I could propose. I think we should do an ATM. And because I think yesterday, in retrospect, I should change hats, but I'm lazy. I think that was more of a lesson fragment, and it was highlighting certain aspects of what you would encounter in the wild. It was like the zoo equivalent to an ATM lesson. It was just some part of it really disconnected from the wild environment that you would usually find it in. some tactics that you would find existing in the lesson, but it was the highlight was on the tactic and you kind of missed the wholeness of the lesson. Anyway, my perspective at the moment, it was unnatural. And it was also your first time doing something. So not really, because we did it the week before, because, you know, I told you I'm the kind of teacher that almost always gives you the answers before I ask the question. But we did it without it being highlighted. And maybe it was too big of an ask. So I would like to do a fuller lesson or fuller version of what we did just a part of yesterday. All right, so you're going to need the roller and a chair. If this was Star Wars, it would be a prequel, like what came before what we did yesterday. All right, if you're up for it.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, really, Dolly Price teachers are pretty much suckers for ATM lessons, aren't we? Like, who would say no? I don't know. I don't mean to be fat-headed about that. Kara, I saw what you wrote in the notes, and I appreciate that. She said she was excited when I was asking, you know, how you were feeling about this process or the demand. And since I want to give you a different experience than yesterday, we're going to start somewhere different, perhaps a little less indulgent. So let's start with you sitting in the chair without the roller, just sitting. So you're going to need a fairly straight back chair. You want your feet to be on the floor. That's sometimes, depending on your proportions, difficult to find because chairs are built for the average person and no one, you know, average is a mathematical invention. It's no one is average, right? Somebody might happen to be the same proportion, but not average. Or they're average by accident. Anyway. So if you need, like, especially if your legs, if you don't reach the floor, you can put books underneath or something firm, nothing mushy. A rolled up or folded up blanket, but not a fluffy blanket. Kneeling pads, whatever. If the chair is, if you're sitting in a hole and your knees are much higher than your hip joints, then, you know, put things underneath your buttocks, books or pads, firm again, that take you to a height that's comfortable. Otherwise, you will be fighting the environment the whole time, which will make it hard, difficult, if not impossible, to pay attention to the kinds of things we want to pay attention here, pay attention to here. So your feet are on the floor, you're toward the forward half, you're on the forward half of the bottom of the chair, the seat pan. And so you're not resting against the back of the chair or the wall or whatever. In this moment, the entire weight of your physical being is distributed over, well, 2 feet. Right? You have both feet on the floor. I mean, we could talk about the sections of the feet, but right now, let's say 2 feet, and then your bottom. So we could say your bottom is 2 sitting bones, one on either side, or 2 buttocks. But maybe you experience it as 1 blob. Right? So right now, do you have 3 points of support or 4? Just in your own experience. I mean, we could complicate it. We could say there's the front and the back of each foot. And there's the side of there's the two sides of your pelvis, so that would be 6 points of contact. Can you feel those places? Out of those 6 points, the front of your right foot and your left foot, the front of your foot, meaning the toes and the base of the toes. The back of each foot, meaning the bottoms of your heels. And you know, the bottoms of your heels on the floor aren't not like high heels. They're not a point of support, they're a patch. So you can feel how much of the back of each foot is touching and how much pressure there is underneath it. And then the same thing underneath your buttocks, underneath your sitting bones. What do you feel between your buttocks and whatever you're sitting, whatever the firmness of the chair is? Like, contract your butt muscles, right? Now, if they were already contracted, it's hard to contract them more. Maybe you contract a little, but let them go. And if they are they were contracted, see if you can let them go and make your buttocks mushy, right? So you're not holding on at all with your butt. And then once again, contract them. And when you contract them, you raise up a little bit. The muscles get thicker and shorter. And that lifts you from the chair a bit. Can you feel that? And then you let it go. So in a way, part of what the contact tells you is the tightness of the muscles. But part of what it tells you is where the weight of everything above. If your hands are on the chair, part of the weight of your arms is on the chair. Part of the weight of your arms is on your chest. And everything above your pelvis is either sitting on top of something, you know, on top of your pelvis, and one vertebra stacked on top of the other, the head on the top. So the head would be a top weight, or like your arms, and like your ribs, and like your organs, everything else is a hanging weight. Right? It's hanging over one of the stiff members of your structure, your skeleton, which includes the tissues connecting bone to bone, right? Ligament. Or it's hanging off of that. All of that has got to land on your bottom, maybe some of it transferred towards your feet. You tell how much is forward of your sitting bones? Like between your sitting bones and the tops of your thighs, and how much is behind your sitting bones on the back of your buttocks. Now, slowly shift your weight onto one side of your pelvis and then come back. Enough so that you're, if it's possible, not so you've lifted your buttock totally off of the chair, but that there's no pressure underneath that side. Right? So you're touching, but not being supported. That's a fine distinction. But it's the same way we touch people, right? Full contact, no pressure. So can you do that with your butt on the chair? And then, you know, come back to where you were. Do that same movement a number of times. So go in the same direction. And then come back. When you come back, can you make that slow? So you take a little longer in the return. Can you, when you come back, can you shift over and feel it? It's like not the beginning, like being on one side, and then the end being on both sides of your buttocks, your weight on both sides, not necessarily evenly, but pressing down. Not just make it like A and B, but you notice the trip home. Can you make the loading, the shifting of the weight onto the buttock that was just touching and not weighted, can you make that gradual rather than sudden Are there jumps? Are there moments where you boom, but just you let go of it? Now notice what else is moving beside your pelvis. Right? Because shifting your weight means that everything above is moving over your base of support. What you feel on the support surfaces at your feet and under your pelvis is the result of moving in a gravitational field, right? You don't actually, I don't know if we sense gravity, we sense the consequences of its action, which is what happens on your base of support. So this is telling you about your relationship to gravity. I'm asking you to notice what's moving above. What's moving in the same direction as your weight is? Whatever direction that is, right? You're going toward one side. Do your shoulders go toward that same side? Does your head go towards it? Does your chest? If your arms are dangling, they're just being passengers. So you're not pushing or pulling on anything with your arms. In a way, this is asking you to notice what's happening proximally. Good. Stop, rest a moment. Now, would you do the same thing, shift your weight to the side, but go the other way? So you're shifting onto the pelvis, the side of your pelvis you lifted off of moments ago. What's the quality of the action at the beginning? Is there some aspect of the motion of this kind of primary activity that we do, taking the weight off of one side? Do you, if you slow down, just pay attention to the beginning. Do you notice is it more difficult to hoist up that side, to shift your weight over? Does it feel more effortful? I mean, I'm guessing if it was the second side, most likely it's a side that's not as easy. Most likely. What goes in that direction when you shift the weight onto the other side of your pelvis? What's moving in space in that direction? I don't mean this abstractly. Are your shoulders moving that way? But you're not turning. You're just leaning over to the side. Are not bending forward and back? Does your whole chest move? Is your head going with it? Does your head go first? Does it go in the same direction or opposite? We could go in the other direction, not headward, but footward, and say, well, what happens at your feet? When you go in this direction, do you push the side you're moving away from, or do you lift it? I mean, lift the weight off of it, not lift your foot from the floor. Can you notice what happens over time, not at the beginning and the end, but the actual play of your weight on the floor, like from the floor's perspective, from the chair's perspective, from the perspective of your base of support? Good. Stop for a moment. You know, here we just kind of popped into a lesson. It isn't, I mean, the test movement here kind of gives it some relevance, but it doesn't connect to anything you would do after you get up, unless chair dancing is something you're interested in. I mean, it does connect to posture, but please stand up for a moment. So here we've reduced the number of places that the amount of real estate you're using to support yourself. And in all the positions you are normally in, this is the one where a small contact area, a small base of support is supporting everything above. And let's take a moment to connect the distinctions you were making to locomotion, to walking. So take a few steps, please. If we look at walking from the perspective of the floor, what you're doing is you're going forward, right? Each step is in front of the other. And you're also going side to side because your weight is shifting from one side, from one foot to the other. And in fact, it has to do that because if you're going to lift a foot up, you have to shift your weight off of it. Normally, we don't notice that. Could you keep walking at the same pace? And notice how before you lift a foot, your weight is off of it, right? So you have your weight on one foot. It's the foot in front. And the other foot swings through, or you pick it up and you put it down in front of the foot that was formerly in front. Before you can pick it up, the weight has to come off of it, right? So you put it down in front of you. The weight was behind you. You put your foot down, you shift your weight onto it. And the moment your weight is off of it, you can swing through and shift, right? So there's the side to side aspect of going forward. Can you notice that and keep moving kind of normally? So don't shift into zombie walk, but just like everyday walk. Now, I highlighted a certain aspect of what's going on. And that's what you notice. And that's what we normally notice. Stop for a moment. But you missed something. I mean, maybe you didn't miss it. I didn't say it. But that is not all that happens from the floor's perspective. Walk again. Because there is that moment, it's brief, where you are on one foot. The other foot touches down. You are on 2 feet. And then you're on one foot. And then you're on 2 feet. So that moment where you're on 2 feet, maybe you didn't notice it. Can you keep walking at a normal pace? And I mean, what you'll notice is, you know, you land, most of us, you land on the front of one foot. No, you land on the back of the foot, right? The back of the foot in front hits the ground first. And there's a moment after it hits the ground when the foot behind and the foot in front are both on the floor. And then as you shift onto the front of the foot that's in front, at some moment, at some time, some particular to you moment, the foot behind lifts. So it's one foot, both feet. The other foot, both feet. One foot. And in that cycling, there is a side to side. You shift onto one foot. There is a moment where you're more or less in the middle. You're on both feet. And then you're on the other side. And I dare say that the way you shift from side to side is the same way as you shift it when you were sitting. That's a presupposition. Can you walk and find what you noticed in sitting in your walking? Like the difference of shifting from side to side. I mean, it's there. We just don't notice it. Or we notice the consequence of it. But here I'm asking you to walk normally, because if you can't notice it when you walk normally, how will you be able to do anything about it when you walk normally? All right, please come back, sit in your chair. You can lean back and have a rest. What did you notice as you did, you know, followed my instructions or didn't, as you heard my instructions? What was easy? What was easier than you thought it was going to be? And what wasn't? What was challenging? Please get the roller, put the roller behind you. So the roller is upright, And it's lined up with the separation of your butt cheeks, right and left, right? It's in the middle, more or less. Yeah, is it? And then it's lined up with the vertical line. And you are touching in at least two places. Some place at the bottom of your pelvis is touching. Right now, if you're, you have to be forward on the chair, right? And your sitting bones are probably still on the chair, right? Even though you're a little, on the, they're kind of where they were before, maybe on the front half. But you're touching not just underneath your pelvis, but behind. So you could say that adds a dimension. Makes me think of Christopher Alexander talking about the difference in the feeling in a room if it has one window, you know, on one wall, or a window on two connected walls, right, at right angles to each other, how that changes the feeling in the room. And I think if you have a second point of reference, perhaps it gives you that added dimension, makes something clearer about how tilted your pelvis is or how shifted it is. What does feeling the sense of the roller behind you and the roller underneath of you, how does that help you understand how you're sitting, how your weight is distributed, the shape that you take? Then we could ask that same question of the second place, which is a place somewhere in the back of your chest, where the back of your spine is touching, perhaps the center of the back of the vertebral processes. Are they a little to the side of the roller? And if the roller is upright, what does that tell you? If the middle of your sacrum, that flat bone at the bottom of your pelvis, is touching the line of the roller, how do you line up with it above? It makes it really clear that we're not standing up straight like a, you know, ramrod. If you slowly, just really slowly, if you tilt your head back as if you want to touch the roller, you don't actually have to touch it. Right? So this is not reverse pecking. You're not taking your chin back. You could do that if you want it. But I'm asking you to tilt your head. So you might touch at the top of your head or the top of the back of your head might touch the roller. Just barely. Don't go beyond that. If it doesn't touch, it doesn't matter. But you could feel that to take your head back, is it just a movement of your neck? Perhaps, but you start to feel something in the top of your chest. Maybe your weight shifts underneath your pelvis or behind you. The place where your chest is touching or where your the back of your pelvis is touching. So we can use these other two places to help us get a better sense of the rest of the parts of your spine you might not notice. So not just both ends, but what happens in the middle. Rest the backs of your hands on your thighs if you haven't. Close enough to you so your arms are as much as possible, you're just letting them rest there. You're not leaning on them, but you're not holding the weight of your arms up. And would you please tilt in the second direction, right? Not the way you went at first when you were sitting before, but in the second way, the way we didn't go yesterday. And notice what, so your pelvis shifts, your weight is shifting, but what happens above, there are a myriad of ways, a number, not such a big number, basically, I think you have three options of how you do it. But whether you remember what they are or not, when you tilt over to the side, is that something that happens between your pelvis and your chest? In other words, does your chest stay still when your pelvis tilts to that side? Does it go up or down? Do you slide in relationship to the place you're touching your back? Do you tilt? Do you roll around the roller? As much as possible, we're looking at tilting, but what are you doing? Right? So if that place doesn't move, then the motion, the action is happening below wherever that is in your rib cage, in your spine. It could be happening right at the place you're touching, you're articulating in the joints that are making contact with the roller. And you would feel that. That would be different than moving below. And if you're moving above, then a place that's touching is going to go right or left. If your head and the upper chest and the shoulders are moving laterally to one side or the other, that place might be engaged. Can you feel that? Please stop and rest a moment. Just a brief one. And now go the other way. What was your, the side that you did first, right? The side you shifted to first. That's not a one-sided movement. In order for that to happen, on the side that you're leaving, you have to work, right? The muscles on the side you're going away from somewhere are working to shift you to the other side. Can you feel where that is? What happens behind your pelvis, right? How does the sacrum move in relation to the roller? So here you have to have enough contact with the roller so that you can feel it behind you, but not so much that you create friction. So full contact, no pressure. Well, not no pressure, but just barely any pressure. And same thing with your chest. What happens there when your pelvis tilts to the side? Can you feel where you're working above your pelvis? Well, maybe you're not. You could be pushing with the foot on the floor on the side that you're leaving. But again, that would fit the general guideline. You have to work on the side you're leaving to get to the other side. You can't pull yourself over there. Well, maybe you can. Yeah, because you could pull up your pelvis on that side, or you could push your foot down, or both. You feel where you're working? Can you feel how your pelvis is moving? Not just by feeling what happens underneath your butt, but behind it. And not just what happens with your pelvis, but what happens with your chest. How does the roller behind you, by not moving, by indicating the upright, kind of help you make sense out of what you're sensing, decode all the signals from the various neurons in various places, to give you a clearer picture of the orchestration or a sense of how the ribs, the vertebrae, your shoulders are moving? Does your head tilt? Or does it move to the side without tilting? Right, translate. It stop and rest back against the roller. If that's not comfortable, you can remove the roller and rest against the chair. But can you find a way to give the roller a bit more weight? You can move your pelvis if you want on the chair, move your feet, and just slouch. Please come back to sitting against the roller. So I think in ATM classes, I mean, if I could for a year make a rule, I would say you're not allowed to teach awareness-driven movement. I mean, to call a class awareness-driven movement. You can certainly use the methodology, but why advertise it something that almost no one knows what it is? Right? So I think you want to teach, I don't know, a class about taking your shoes on and off. Right? Or carrying your baby, getting in and out of the car, opening the door, sitting down, getting packages in and out. You know, lessons related to that because I was like, I thought about what Scott said the other day, or was it last week or yesterday? I don't remember. Yesterday. When he's talking about these activities, tennis and singing, in which he was applying the method. Right? People come because of the specificity of what they want to do. So teach classes for singers, right? Or tennis players. So here we this class, let's say it's about walking, right? That there needs to be a context because that answers the so what question. It also gives, I mean, so what it motivates someone, it's meaningful. In the language of 1968, when I was really young, too young to use it, you know, I think the word would have been relevance. Lessons have to be relevant from the get-go. Because that also means the person will have a situation which will reoccur in which they can apply and practice applying the skills that they learned. Come back to sitting and so yesterday we worked with we explored one configuration or two configurations. Let's go back to the last one. So that would be and we'll do this on the easy on the easier side. So you're going to lift your pelvis on the easier side. Stop for a second. Let's change it. Yeah, you're going to lift your pelvis on the easier side. So, whatever side that is, you hold. I'm changing this from yesterday. You hold the chair on the opposite side. Right. So the side that's easy, you hold the chair with the hand on the opposite side. You put the hand on the side that lifts easily. Put that hand on your head. With your fingers oriented toward your ear or your shoulder, not towards the front or the back. And now you just lower your head a few times. So you take the elbow toward the floor. It doesn't go straight down like an elevator, it makes an arc. Just this simple movement. And here the idea is not to take the elbow forward or backwards, but just sideward. I think that's not so easy for most of us. So rather than fight what you're doing, notice the, which way you tend to drift. As your elbow goes to the side, does it start to point a little more to the front or to the back? And then take your elbow just a little to the side and take deviate it the way that you tend to. So if it goes backward as you go down, just take your elbow slightly back. If it goes forward, take it slightly forward. Stay tilted. Now, the funny thing is you're in a configuration when you move your elbow, your hand moves, right? They're connected. But now you've connected your elbow to your hand, to your head. So now when your elbow moves, your head is turning. Just that little bit. It turns a little and comes back. Can you make that smoother? But when your elbow moves, your hand moves, your shoulder moves, the bottom of your head and the base of your neck or the top of your chest, they're all moving together. So that teeny little twisting is happening somewhere below the top of your chest. If it isn't, then your hand is, and your head are sliding. But if there's no sliding there, they're fixed. You don't have to hold them tight. Just move them together. Something happens in your chest. Can you feel that? Stop. And now go the other way. So if your elbow is going forward, go backward. It doesn't have to be far. Just a little. And notice if you can tell what happens in your chest when you go in the other direction. Go back, bring it the way you did it at first. Can you feel the qualitative difference? Meaning how easy it is for you, the shape of your chest to change when you go in the easier direction. Now come back to being upright. And again, tilt your head in that same direction. So you're tilting your head in the direction of the side that your pelvis lifts on easier. And you might notice that when you tilt your head this way, and if you, as much as possible, go sideways and down, forward and backward, something happens at the bottom, whether you want it to or not. Okay, now, it doesn't mean it has to, but with a lot of people, somewhere, even in that teeny movement that you're making, just the easy part, tilting in the easy direction, something's already happened with your pelvis, right? So you're not going sideways. It's not like you're taking your elbow towards the wall at the side. It's when you take your elbow down, your ear is going more toward the ceiling, right? Everything is moving like that. Can you feel that your pelvis, the weight shifts in the opposite direction than the one you're tilting? I mean, it only has three choices. It doesn't move. It shifts in the same direction or shifts in the opposite. Can you tell what you're doing? And now, lift it on purpose. So lift the side you're tilting to. Do you lift it before you tilt, at the same time as you tilt, or after? Don't change it. Don't change it. It's really hard. I mean, just can you notice it and fight the compulsion to do something, anything different? I think awareness in some moments is really discomforting. To notice what you're doing, why you're doing it. Not to judge or evaluate it, not to change it. Maybe to make it a little easier. But here I'm asking, what's first? You tilt your head and your arm over. Do you tilt your pelvis first? Or do they happen together? Good. Come back and rest a moment. So the unspoken parts, I mean the necessary aspects of movement, that the things that have to happen when we move, and the things that we do in a different way to talk about this, in that unconscious, competent ways that we do them, right? They serve us. We don't have to think about it. It just happens. All of that is out of our awareness. I mean, not just having accomplished, you know, shifting your weight, but everything we have to do that. And if change comes by paying attention to the means whereby we do something, like the actual physical happenings, then it's by making the tacit aspects to bring them into light, maybe even to bring them into words, that it can begin to change what wasn't in our control, because then we start to notice it. So come back, same position. You're holding onto the chair on the side that you're moving toward. Your arm is staying straight for now. And you put your other hand on top of your head. And now, keeping your hand on your head, can you shift your weight in the easy direction? Now, if you shift your weight, even just a little, if you keep your arm straight, so there's just no variance in your wrist, in your elbow, or in your shoulder. It's just a stick. And maybe your arm tilts a little. You don't have to grip the chair. Just hold on lightly. Does the rest of you move over? So do your ribs move closer to your straight arm or further away? Does your shoulder, the one above the hand that's holding the chair, does it move left or right? Or just thinking about that dimension for the moment. Did your head move, even though you didn't tilt it? Did it shift over in space? Is it possible to lift your pelvis even the tiniest amount, like to lift it enough to break contact, but not to totally leave the chair, right? It just, or to take the pressure away, to keep the contact, but with no pressure. Can you do that without moving your shoulder, without moving your head? Something has to happen. If your head's not going to move, if your shoulder's not going to move, somewhere between your pelvis and your shoulders. So in the spine between your pelvis and your chest, or in the spine of your chest, between your lower back and the base of your neck. It's not abstract. It has to happen somewhere. Don't struggle to try to keep the movement from happening. I mean, to try to keep your upper body from shifting. Good. Now, next time you lift the pelvis, keep it lifted. And slowly tilt your head down in the same way we've been doing. So tilt your head towards the lifted side of your pelvis without bringing your elbow forward or back. That might limit how far you go, but that's fine. You don't have to go that far. Notice that something happens somewhere in your chest with your ribs and the vertebrae of your chest, and maybe the lower vertebrae between your chest and your lower back. Probably it's not all of your vertebrae. Probably it's one place, or maybe two areas, two neighborhoods. Can you feel where that is? And when you tilt your head over, is it between your shoulder blades or below? I mean, that part of your chest. Or below your chest and just in your lower back. When you tilt your head like that and the bending happens somewhere in you, does your pelvis move? I'm not saying you should keep it still. Is there any possibility of tilting your head to the side without holding your breath to do this and not have your weight shift a little, not underfoot, but under butt? It could be underfoot. Maybe something's happening below your feet. Is it possible for your head to have any excursion, any amount of travel, without your weight shifting? Next time you've lowered your head, your pelvis is already lifting. Lift it, stay there. Something appears when you're moving. I mean, it's that makes clear, like, in which parts of your skeleton you are hinging, right? Where the axes of movement are and which parts aren't. When you're still, in a way, it's a bit harder to tell the particulars of the shape, like where the curve of your back, this banana, where it's arc and where it's straighter. Isn't it? I mean, something appears in movement that's harder to tell when you're still. Now, stay there in this bent position and slowly begin to lower your pelvis. The side that's lifted, just a tiny bit closer. So if you're not making contact, you move towards making contact. If you are making contact, you put I don't know, 10% or less of the weight of your whole body back onto that side. All right, so you're still holding up most of yourself. You're only letting a bit down. This is a metaphorical way to speak about it, but I think it makes sense. And then you lift yourself back. You come back to where you were. And you do that a few times. And maybe you notice, like, where do you have to activate this ability to separate things, to lengthen, to let your pelvis move away from your ribs and your shoulder and your head on that side. And then come back. Can you feel where that happens? I mean, generally, we don't, it's harder to feel the, for most of us, to feel the specific address of the muscles, you know, that are moving. But here I think you can. Next time you're lifted up, stay with your pelvis lifted up. And now bring your head and your elbow back up, right? On the same, it's the same side. So you're taking your head up. It's your elbow, your head, your chest, everything is moving together. Something happens in a different part of your spine when you bring your head up. Where is that? Is there a counterbalancing happening at the bottom of yourself? Stop for a moment. If you can notice, well, actually, let's take a break. Put your pelvis down, put your arm down, rest a moment. Come back to the same position. So your hand is on top of your head. You're tilted over. Your pelvis is lifted. You're in this more or less of a C curve, right? Just one arc. And then you're going to take your head back toward the starting position. Don't go very far. Just the beginning. In which places do you feel that movement occurring? Is there a consequence at the bottom, under your feet and under your pelvis, where you're shifting a bit? Or can you bring your head back up without shifting? Don't go all the way, maybe 10%. And at first you might go half or more. So each, don't try to change it immediately, when just repeat it. The next time go less far. Stop when your head is part of the way back. Can you find your breath there? Listen to the rhythm of your breathing. And now, as you breathe out, lower your head. And then as you breathe in, lift it. Not all the way, just like you're riding the wave of your breath. Don't change the rhythm of your breathing to fit the movement, but fit the movement to ride the rhythm of your breath. When you're breathing out, you're lowering your head. You're not dropping it. So this is allowing, but it's an action. It's not passive, right? Because it is an activation of the muscle. It's a doing. And it's in partnership with gravity, because the gravity, instead of the muscle, is the motive force. Your muscles being the brake. Please put your pelvis back, lift your head up, and just sit for a moment. Notice how you're sitting. Behind yourself, underneath yourself, your pelvis and your feet. Shift yourself in the easy direction, however you do it. Are you perhaps more aware of what you're doing to do this? Did it get easier? Shift yourself in the opposite direction. Okay. Please stop and go for a short stroll. Now, you know, the next question is, it is a totally sincere question. Like, I have no idea what the answer is for you. What do you notice when you do this? How did what we did together, the movements you just engaged in, the questions you asked yourself, did they change what you notice about this? About the way you're walking, the way you're, the shifting weight part, I mean, on one foot, both feet. The other foot, both feet. Is there something different about what you notice, what you can notice, or what's available to you? And did something change in how you're doing this? Please come back to the chair. Sit with the roller behind you. Feel these points of contact under and behind. So you're leaning ever so slightly back so you can feel the roller behind you without tilting your head back. I think we've clarified or established that there was, at least at the beginning, an easier direction, right, for shifting your weight. I've been asking you the whole exploration yesterday and in today's lesson to do it this in the easy way. That's, you know, to improve what's easy. It's definitely a Feldenkraisian thing, and it seems ridiculous to most people. Right? I think you understand why we do it. I think when we're working with our students, it's worthwhile not explaining, but making evident as we're doing something why this matters or how it makes a difference. But let's go the other way. So lift your pelvis on the less easy side, or what was the less easy side? Maybe it changed. And we're in the middle of an exploration. And at that time, habits become slightly destabilized or perhaps less compulsive. Maybe you get a brief break from that insistent imposition, or maybe it's still there, but just notice what's it like? How easy is it? That's a qualitative aspect. The more you do this, the more you shift to the side you were shifting away from before, does it get easier or more difficult? Does the impediment or the difficulty, does it get stronger? And you may not notice what's causing it, or because you may notice this, I don't know, behind one eyeball or in your throat or in your neck and one ankle, right? I mean, it somehow fits with these other things that you're doing. Let's see if I can. Sit for a moment. Put your hand, the one that's on the side you were tilting away from just now, the side where you were lifting your pelvis, put that hand on top of your head, the opposite hand of a few moments ago. And now slowly tilt your head in the direction on the more difficult side of lifting your pelvis, which is what we were just doing, right? So you tilt your head that way. Your hand holds onto your head. It doesn't have to have a big grip, but for a moment, make a grip like, I don't know, like your head might try to run away. So hold with, I don't know, twice, or if it's comfortable, three times the force. What you did before, if you were doing minimally, it wouldn't be much still, but you activate your hand and grip. And now tilt. And you'll notice if you activate your hand and that you're doing a lot of work there, your attention will be drawn to it. Stop. Let's make this a smaller action. So how far can you tilt your head without moving your shoulder? Right? So there is a teeny bit of wiggle room where your head will move around your chest. At some point you use that up and your elbow and your head and your shoulder all move together. Can you explore that range? Now, I think when you did that, you started holding on less with your hand, right? So do that on purpose. You hold on less, you're tilting your head. If you're watching yourself in the screen, you want to make sure that as you tilt, you're not turning, right, forward or back. Just feel, what is it like to tilt on this side? How does that compare to what it was like on the other side? Now, when you're tilting, something happens in that top of your chest and your spine, as well as below. But it's calling for something below your neckline. Where's the first place below that that moves? Okay, stop. Leave your hand up. Your hand on top of your head, and now lift that side of your pelvis. Notice, as you lift that side of your pelvis, does your lower back or somewhere in your spine, do you arch and round? Is there a little twisting to it? Can you make it less of that, less arching and rounding, not by forcing? Just, I don't know, how would you do less without forcing something different to happen? You have to change something about the beginning. Or with less turning. Notice when you lift that side of your pelvis, do you push with that foot? Or do you take that foot slightly away? You know, it's as if you're lifting your foot, you're taking all the pressure away from it, but you're still staying on the floor. So that, you know, are you lifting away? Are you pushing into? Or are you just letting your foot stay there without the pressure changing at all? And let's play with that. So can you push with your foot? So push the foot you're moving away from into the floor, and not suddenly, so not all at once. In other words, the more your pelvis lifts, the more your pressure pushes. It's proportional. And if your pelvis is going smoothly, not jumping, not rushing, but going smoothly, then the pressure underfoot is the same. Your head's not tilting, your elbow's not coming down. Maybe your body is moving a bit side to side. Is it moving to the right or left? Both are possible. It could be staying just where it is. That's the hardest choice. Not impossible. All right, now, can you lift your pelvis without increasing the pressure or decreasing the pressure underneath that foot? So your foot stays on the floor, it doesn't press more, it doesn't press less. That will change the muscles that you need to activate. That might change how your shoulders move or what happens with your head and your elbow. Does your elbow go up, down, side to side? It doesn't go forward or back, right? Because we're just for the moment not concerned with that. And as much as you can you eliminate that so you're not turning? It might just mean you move less. Okay, stop for a moment. Put your arm down. Come back to the beginning place. And I think you might have had this experience of when somebody tickles your foot, right? And what happens is you have this like response of pulling away from, right? Like the whole leg kind of retracts. Do you know what I mean? Or like if you, you know, touch something prickly with your foot, right? And you pull back from it. Without lifting your foot, can you do that? Just the slight action of pulling your foot away from the floor, or your whole leg, so that the pressure underneath your foot almost entirely vanishes, but you're still touching the floor. Right? And you might notice that your shoulders and your head move. That's okay. Just make it really small so you're not lifting, but you're pulling up. Yeah? Cool. Put your hand on top of your head. Just so you, if your elbow moves, it's kind of like a flag. It'll indicate how your head and your chest are moving. Now, lift up your foot. Lift your foot away. Sorry. Lift your foot away from the floor without taking it off the floor as you lift up that side of your pelvis. Right. So the weight, whatever weight was resting on that foot, you have to shift it to somewhere else at the same time as you shift the pressure off the bottom of your pelvis on that side and you shift your weight the other direction. Perhaps one of those three options feels familiar. I'm guessing one of those three options feels more difficult, not necessarily physically difficult, but just like wrapping your head around it, finding it, doing it just in that way, which probably gives you some indication of what you do most of the time and what you probably do very little of the time. Good. And now lower your head and lift your pelvis. Do it at the same time. Is it easier at the same time? Did something change about the movement of the top and the bottom together by exploring them separately? Okay, next time your arm is and head are lowered and your pelvis is lifted, stay there. And now slowly, you're holding on to the chair on the other side, slowly keeping the distance between your shoulder and your hip the same. So keeping this shape, lower yourself a bit so that your pelvis approaches touching the chair. You don't have to go that far. So now you're tilting away from the arm that's holding onto the chair, which is why you're holding onto it, but keeping the distance the same. So you're moving as a solid piece. You know, if you're moving as a solid piece, you're moving everything around the hip joint of the side of your pelvis that's on the chair at the beginning. Everything is moving around that and around your shoulder and your elbow and your wrist and your hand, where you're holding onto the chair. Everything else is a piece. So you're tilting toward the floor, and then you're coming back. The pelvis on the side that you're tilting toward and away from, that's moving. Maybe something's happening in that hip joint too. Are you increasing the pressure under your foot on that side? Do you need to? That's a variation, right? That's an undifferentiated movement that you're familiar with, right? But this idea, once again, keep your pelvis lifted and your head where it is, of lifting your head up, coming back towards the neutral, and then lowering, keeping your pelvis lifted. That's a thing that is unusual in what we're doing. I think it's unusual, isn't it? Especially Noticing the lowering part, what that means. When you bring your pelvis back down, does the weight change underfoot? Anyways, now come back to the beginning. And now lower your head and your elbow. Hold on to the chair, but don't lift your pelvis. Just do that a few times. Slowly, don't go far. Notice what happens at the very beginning. So the very beginning, I mean, gravity's on your side. You're lowering your head. It's really a matter of controlling the fall, the weight of yourself on that side. Maybe you can feel the places in which that happens, but wait, come back to the beginning. The very beginning of tilting over. How much can you notice of what happens then? Your head and your arm, and your head and your arm, your elbow, your shoulder, your neck, the top of your chest, they're all moving together. They're moving in the direction of falling. It's kind of like just letting go. Do you notice what happens underneath your pelvis and at your feet? What happens inside your rib cage with your breastbone, with the vertebrae of the ribs in front of your shoulder blades, you know, the upper half of your chest compared to what happens below? Can you notice all of that at the very beginning? So when you're bending over with your head and your arms and all that weight, you start to hinge somewhere. Could be at the very top of your spine. Could be at the place right at the bottom of your shoulder blades or at the bottom of your rib cage. It might spread, but it starts somewhere, which is unlikely to be everywhere. Can you feel that? And then if you go further, do you move more in that same area, in the same joint or joints? Does the movement incorporate more joints? Is it spread evenly? Does it go upward or downward? Or does it jump and some other place start moving? Good. Come back, put your arm down, and now rest. Let's do just a little more, okay? If you've had enough, you can stop and listen along. You will have the recording. We are recording. So don't compress yourself. As we continue too, I mean, sometimes the expectation is you should be able to do more, more easily, go further. I mean, if it isn't getting easier, definitely do less or just imagine. But don't try to squeeze a little bit more out of it. Let's see what happens without that. So come back to the same configuration. The same hand is on top of the head, on top of your head. The elbow is pointing to the side as much as it's comfortable for you. Your other hand is holding onto the side of the chair. Your arm is straight without being rigid. And now lift your pelvis and lower your elbow and your head. When you do both, lower your elbow and your head on top and lift your pelvis on the bottom, where does that begin? Does it begin in the same place as you were noticing before? Up between your shoulders or below or at the very bottom? Doesn't have to be big. Can you feel how the changing shape of your of everything, I mean, of your skull and your spine and your chest and your pelvis and your arms and your legs, how that's related to the shifting of weight? Is the shifting weight happening smoothly? Is the movement into this kind of bent, crescent-like shape, is it smooth? Are there places where there are bumps or stops? What happens if you don't go past them? Just work on making the easier part a little smoother and easier, and on feeling more of what's happening. Not hopping from one place to the other, but somehow being able to envelope all of that inside how you notice yourself moment to moment. All right, next time you're tilted over, stay there. And now keeping yourself in this bent position, lift your head, lift your elbow, and now go a little further than what you did before. So your pelvis stays lifted and your head comes back toward the vertical. As much as you can, keep your head over your hip joint. So in other words, when you tilt over, right, your head's no longer over the middle of your pelvis, where the back of your sacrum is touching the roller. Your head tilts over to the side, to the side that's lifting. So now, can you bring your head back up without bringing it back to the center? Well, I don't think you bring it back to the center, even if you were trying to. It's hard to do. So don't try. But now what's happening is you have one arc in your bottom half, right? And then when you lift your head back up, you're not straightening your spine, but you're creating an arc in the other direction, right? So it's a C facing the other way, or two C's, or an S. You're curving your head and your neck. You're curving your neck to bring your head up in the opposite direction that you're curved below, which is what you would have to do if you had this, you know, wicked scoliosis and you wanted to keep your eyes on the horizon, which is something, again, Dr. Feldenkrais, Moshe, talked about. Now, keep your head up. This is not easy to do, I don't think. I could be wrong. Keeping your head up and keeping this shape, right? Not lowering your pelvis, not changing the angle of your neck. Slowly lower your pelvis so you tilt yourself over in this funny shape. And then you come back. So the relationship between your head, your arm, your neck, and your chest, and your shoulders and your ribs and your pelvis and your, all of that stays the same. And you're tilting this funny S-shaped thing so you come closer to touching the chair. You're holding onto the other side because all of your weight is going to be easy to fall. Do not go so far that you have to work really hard to hold yourself up. The important thing is keeping the shape and just on the bottom of your butt, tilting a little bit from side to side. Come back to where you were at the beginning. Keeping your head where it is, slowly lower your pelvis toward the chair and come back. Don't try to touch. Just how far can you go easily? And now a lot of yourself is involved in keeping the same shape. Your head to your chest, your upper chest. Something is changing. Well, below your shoulders and above your pelvis, maybe in the bottom half of your rib cage and spine of your chest, something is happening at your waist or in the floating ribs. Can you feel that? Lower as slowly and as smoothly as you can. Wait a moment and breathe. Slowly bring your pelvis back to where it was. Can you feel how the weight shifts under your butt and at your feet? It's difficult because only part of yourself is free to move here. But that difficulty means it's easier to feel what happens there because everything else is quiescent. Please sit up. Put your pelvis down, put your arms down, just rest. You can rest back against the roller. What do you notice? I mean, if you'd rather take the roller away and put it on the floor next to you and rest back on the chair, that's fine. Something that happened while you were doing these movements is, are you still thinking about that? Or are you noticing? Can you notice how you're resting? Even if you're slouching back, how much weight is underfoot? How much weight is on your bottom? Is it more on the back of your bottom or the bottom of your bottom? More on one side or the other? What parts of the back of your chest, of the vertebrae of your chest, are touching the roller or the chair or the wall or the floor if you decided to go back there? Where's your head? How are you breathing? Please come back up to sitting. So if you can put the roller behind you, that'd be cool. Just for a few moments if you took it out. Put your hands on your thighs. Just shift your weight to one side. You pick whatever happens automatically. Notice what the rest of yourself is doing. I mean, you know, if you are, I don't know, maybe the Feldenkrais method is a perfect profession for sociopaths and compulsive liars, right? Because you say, shift your weight. Well, really, shifting your weight is the result. If you were being honest, scrupulously honest, you would say to your students and yourself, move yourself so that your weight shifts, right? We make that invisible. Because we describe the consequence and not how you get there. We're talking about the destination. And then shift your weight the other way a few times. And I ask you not to go side to side because I think it's much easier to tell the difference when you go in one direction, at least more than one time, because you never know what you missed the second time, right? You never know what you missed the first time. So at least the second time, maybe three or four. And then you can compare side to side. Did something change in the ease with which you do that? And then when you're ready, stand up, go for a walk. Take your time. I mean, you don't have to jump up. You can stand before you walk. You can shift your weight while you're standing. And then you can walk and find out if whatever you're noticing or whatever has changed, or both, how you're noticing has changed and how you're moving has changed. What appears for you? I mean, it's not like you have to look for it. It'll be there. And, you know, whatever it is that you notice now might give you an indication of what to explore and return to. And I think should also be the basis of whatever you do next. Like if you're working with a teacher. Well, this changed and this didn't, or I noticed this, or this captured my interest. So that we are building on what happened before. It's not like every lesson is an independent occurrence, but as a part of this ongoing educational discovery, self-discovery, co-discovery, I think we should take a break. How about if we come back? Well, actually, before we do that, if you want to take a break, stop. I'll put the time in a few moments in the chat, so you don't have to participate in this conversation. It will be recorded. But if you're someone who wants or needs to say something now, let's take a few moments. I don't think I'll entertain questions. I'll entertain them, but I won't answer them. Since Hank got me before. First rights to say something are to the people who have said nothing. Perhaps for good reason. Anybody have something you want to say? Not required. All right. Well, should you need me, if you don't know how to get a hold of me, well, you should. Just in case, I'm going to put my phone number in the chat. So if you want to talk to me, I am going to be Egan, but if there's something you need to say, then, you know, you can say it. Don't feel compelled, but there you go. But let's have lunch. 5 minutes after. You know, so whatever hour we're close to, wherever you live, whatever the next hour is,